Deep gratitude for your Donna. Thank you for your presence, for your practice, and for having me here tonight. I'm really it's just never gets old, does it? The beauty of the Dharma and the refuge of Sangha really never gets old. It's just as beautiful as it was. I remember the first time I came to a mindfulness class. It was 1990. It was November 1990. I was suffering a lot and emotionally, and I tried therapy and some different things, and I was just feeling forlorn. And a friend suggested that we go to try a beginning meditation class. And it just so happens we were living in Berkeley, which was just where I still live. And it just so happens that it was being taught by James Beres. And I don't remember that first class at all, but I do remember my first mindful breath in the midst of, just sort of the chaos of learning about this new concept. And it was just ever so boring, just breathing in and breathing out. How could such a thing be so transformative? But it was even then, in those moments, there was something about taking defusing from thought and moving attention to something that I had never in my life been taught to pay attention to, my breathing, and just the kind of moment of peace that came with that. So I became, I started going on retreat set in early 1991. I did my first week-long meditation retreat at Land of Medicine Buddha with Gil Fronsdal. And I've never looked back. So here we are, and I know many of you have stories not unsimilar. We have our way, all these different stories that lead us to this moment together that's so precious to share Dharma and be together in Sangha. So tonight I want to go into this theme of disidentifying from challenging thoughts. And the Buddha has some very specific suggestions, which I will go into. Beautiful teachings. Many of them, actually, and I won't go into all of them, but just mostly one or two. And I guess before I start sharing some of this, I just want to ask us all to consider why. Why would it be valuable to put life effort? Well, I mean, in some ways, we've all already answered this because we're here, but why is there value in putting life effort into disidentifying from thoughts that we're aware are distressing? And really the answer is so obvious that isn't it so much better when we can be in a place of contentedness, peace? And very often, if we just drop into the present moment, we have a pleasant or a neutral experience. We're just having a moment in a life. And the moment itself is very often neutral. And what's making it challenging is where the mind has gone. Now, this is not always true. Of course, there are actual challenging experiences in life. There always are. But when, you're awake at 3 a.m. worrying about something, what's actually happening? You're safe in your bed. There's the gentle darkness in the room and the comfort of the bed and the simplicity of your breathing. There's nothing inherent in the lived moment that would be causing distress. But we can be, and I, speaking from personal experience, quite distressed because the mind has gone somewhere that doesn't serve us. Jack Kornfield says, our life is shaped and determined by our thoughts. Usually we're only half conscious of the way thoughts direct our life. We're lost in thoughts as if they are reality. We take our own mental creations quite seriously, endorsing them without reservation. We have a habit of believing that there is a self kind of running the thoughts. But really the thoughts, we use mindfulness to look and see the thoughts are generating the sense of self. And this is all learned and conditioned. But I'll get more into that. If we don't have to take our own mental creations seriously, endorsing them without reservation. And that's one of the incredible doorways to freedom that our practice offers us. So before I go into the Buddhist teachings about this, I want to ask the question, what are thoughts, from the privileged position of where we are in this period of time where there's so much neuroscience going on. So thoughts begin to form when neurons signal other cells, phioneurotransmitters. There's release of chemicals. There's a release of electrical signals. There's associations, and thoughts are formed. Thoughts are representations of reality, not reality itself. There are seven major brain networks, and I'll just mention them briefly. For those like me who think these things are so interesting, the seven major brain networks that have been named are the sensory motor, which is touch and movement, visual, which is a big one, seeing is a big project, the limbic brain, which regulates reactions, behavior, and emotions, the central executive network, which is in charge of tasks and decision making, the default mode network, which is the internal mind, the self-talk, the salience network, which is a whole network that's entire job is deciding which other networks are going to be active. And then the dorsal attention network, and the dorsal attention network is all about attention, all about, you know, how we pay attention. When the mind is kind of running thoughts on its own, that's coming from the default mode network, which was discovered by scientists in 2001. So it's relatively new. All this is relatively new information for us. And it's where it's this activity in the that happens in all these different relationships up here in the middle part of the brain, the default mode network, where we go, the thinking mind goes to as a default when we're not focused on a task, when we're not using the central executive network. And the problem with the default mode network, it evolved to, so we could survive, and I'm sure you've heard this before, the problem with the default mode network is it has a natural inborn negativity bias. So it's always, it's telling stories, it's creating a sense of self to protect, and is always scanning for problems in the past, scanning for problems in the moment, and scanning for potential problems in the future. And if we're kind of caught by this a lot, it will activate our nervous system and be dysregulating. And many of us go through life, many humans go through life, rather at the mercy of the default mode network. So, but thoughts are just mental activity in the brain. They're not reality. And we have a constant torrent of them. We're not going to, with our practice, other than times of deep concentration, which are beautiful but not necessarily transformative, we're not going to be turning off the thoughts. They say that the mind produces thoughts like the mouth produces saliva. And yet, we're not going to be turning them off. It's going to be doing this. And yet, they're a driving force in mood and behavior and life. So What the Buddha discovered, and which is corroborated now by science, is that we have this capacity to relook. We use the dorsal attention network, this, and we use the salience network, the one that's deciding where we go in our brain, and the dorsal attention network, the paying attention part, to move activity out of the default mode network, the inner self-talking mind, move it out of there and up into the central executive network where we're noticing what's happening right now. That's our mindfulness practice. We're no longer in that surround sound, doom and gloom radio station that is our default mode network. And I want to cut the default mode network a little break because it's not all doom and gloom. Like, we know if you're habituated, if you have a sunny personality, or you've had some really lovely conditioning, which many of us have, or if you've had a long-term loving kindness practice and you've habituated loving kindness phrases, the default mode network will produce those too. And those are great. That kind of positivity that can come out when we're just in wandering mind is great. So, there's a lot of other fabulous, useful, crucial mental activity. So it's not that all thinking is bad at all, but we're just focusing, kind of honing in on the parts that create suffering for us and how we can work with them. So mindfulness is what the Buddha discovered, and that what we now know is this relocating of attention out of the default mode network and up into the central executive network. And from this place, as we're observing the present moment, there's the possibility of all kinds of wonderful things. Insight, first of all, which is the translation of the word vipassana. Insight, because we're no longer kind of just listening to the reruns. So insight and wisdom and taking a pause before we react and making a choice, maybe to respond to a moment with a heart practice, like loving kindness or compassion or appreciation or equanimity. There are a lot more options available when we have learned this practice, which is just our mindfulness practice, of relocating what's happening in our minds to another place. I want to quote Dr. Elaine Ryan, who's a psychologist and founder of an organization called MoodSmith, that actually their whole purpose, and it's very beautiful and useful, is to assist people who struggle with intrusive thoughts. Now, we all have intrusive thoughts, actually. Those are unwanted thoughts that come unbidden. They become can become an excruciating problem for people when we identify with them and they get some kind of energy and they keep repeating and they're feeling oppressive and overwhelming. And she works with people with those kinds of things. Dr. Elaine Ryan, and the organization is called MoodSmith. So she's doing great work. As a part of her work, she, works with thoughts generally, and so I wanted to quote her a little bit in this gen in a little teeny piece of an essay that she wrote about thoughts in a general sense. She says, "Thoughts are powerful things. They can make you happy, sad, or anxious, or keep you stuck in a repetitive obsessive spiral. They can affect your health, emotional well-being, and overall outlook on life. It's crucial then to take some time to understand thoughts. The way you think about things affects how you feel and behave. If you have positive, helpful thoughts, you'll feel better and more likely to do something that helps you. On the other hand, if you have negative, harmful thoughts, you'll feel worse and be more likely to do things that negatively impact your life. For example, if you want to change jobs and see an opening in a firm you wish to work in, you think you're capable of getting the job and have the necessary qualifications. You'll apply for the job. You're and are in with a chance of securing the position. However, if you think other people will be better and there's no point in applying, even though you have the required qualifications and experience, you're less likely to apply for the job and as such have zero chance of getting a new job. And the only difference there is what's going on in your mind. What's happening in our minds impacts the whole trajectory of our lives. I've had times where I notice some kind of negative thing going on, and I notice that my habit towards that has been to kind of not worry about it or not take it seriously. And while that's useful to a certain extent, if I'm nonetheless habituating it and reifying it and identifying with it and repeating it, I'm underestimating the power of what a chronic negative thought can be doing to my life. And so it's helpful to just be frank about it. Like, no, thoughts are not reality, but they do impact us quite significantly. And our mindfulness practice and our Brahmaviharas, our heart practices, they're more than meets the eye. They are really, when the Buddha talked about the road to freedom, he wasn't kidding. We're talking about significant transformation of our own well-being and our own courage and capacity to show up in service for others. Thoughts occur in your brain, of course, and are necessary. They're mental representations of information, but they have the power to make changes in our bodies. For example, you can think about your favorite food. And notice sometimes that the mouth might salivate. And why is that? Because the thought represents food that you've previously eaten, and your body prepares to eat and digest it by producing saliva. Similarly, if you think about something that you find scary, the body prepares for that thing, even if it's in no way impinging on the present moment. The science of how thoughts work is a relatively new field, but a wealth of research shows that our thoughts have profound impact on our lives. Okay, so mindfulness. So as we move into, so that's the kind of the why and the what. So we move into, yet another look at our own mindfulness practices and how they support us. As we make that transition, I'm just going to share a poem by David White called Tilico Lake. In this high place, it is as simple as this: leave everything you know behind. Step toward the cold surface. Say the old prayer of rough love and open both arms. Those who come with empty hands will stare into the lake, astonished. There, in the cold light, reflecting pure snow, the true shape of your own face. We make this discovery for ourselves in mindfulness practice, but what's so beautiful, one of the many, many, many beautiful things about these teachings is this understanding that who we are beneath our thoughts is so beautiful. Loving awareness, sky-like mind. Goodness, tenderness, the authentic being. So we work with all these constructions of thought. This is Jack Kornfield again. We must understand the power of the stories we tell and differentiate them from the direct experience of life. In this way, we can use thoughts without being trapped in them. The stories we tell ourselves seduce us. They pull us into a narrative which might not even be all that accurate, and pull us away from the sensory experience of the present moment. So the first Buddhist teaching that I want to reference when we're talking about using mindfulness to work with thoughts is the third foundation of mindfulness. So the four foundations of mindfulness as taught by the Buddha are the body. It's the first one, which includes breath and sight and hearing and all the physical sensations and taste and smell. And awareness of the impermanence of the body and feelings that the Buddha taught about feeling the earth and fire and wind and water in our bodies and just really inhabiting and becoming familiar with the nature-like miraculous qualities of the body. That's the first foundation of mindfulness. The second foundation of mindfulness is what's called feeling tone or vedana, where we're aware that every moment or each aspects of every moment are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's automatic and not necessarily a problem unless we become reactive. So it's very helpful to cultivate mindfulness of feeling tone. And then where I want to bring us is the third foundation of mindfulness, which he called mindfulness of mind, or citta, which is really more understood as mind-heart, minds and emotions, because the stories and the thoughts and the feeling tones that we're reacting and responding to in our minds impact our emotions. So in this third foundation of mindfulness, in many ways, the instruction is super simple, but it's really powerful. It's really just know what's happening. Know what's happening. Craving, he said, if there's a craving mind, know it as craving mind. If there's no craving, no craving. And he's not saying, he goes on, if there's a mind full of hate, know that mind is full of hate. If there's a mind without hate, know that there's a mind without hate. So you can see that, hate's a good example of how the thoughts and the emotions can all be involved, but it can be anything. And what's so cool about this is that he's not saying, oh, there's a mind full of craving, there's a mind full of hate. Shame on you. You should feel bad about yourself. Let's have a little self-denigration party because you are having resentment and you're craving, a cookie or whatever. No. All he's saying is know what's there. And what are we doing when we know what's there in the thinking mind, when we're not completely fused with it? What are we doing? Like I said, we are relocating the activity of the mind from the default mode network to the prefrontal cortex. We're going somewhere else. What we really, especially as Westerners, really need to watch out for in this practice, and my God, I've fallen into this pit hundreds of times, so I know it well, is don't be upset with yourself when you find the conditioning of your mind has brought you to a place of an intrusive thought or, rage or hate or addiction or whatever the kinds of things our minds do. Just know it. That's the third foundation of mindfulness. This is a quote from Sayadaw Utejaniya, who is a current, fantastic Buddhist teacher, monk who lives in Burma and teaches out of Yangon, he says, the mind is thinking. If you know it, it's good enough. There are thoughts. If you know that, it's good enough. Teacher Ruth King talks about seeing the thoughts rather than being the thoughts. Just naming thinking. And if you can, as the Buddha suggests, maybe even naming the specific kind of thinking that's going on. Planning, remembering, fantasizing. I have a whole station on the radio in my brain that I call the Family of Origin show. Just like the, you know, stories from my family. You know, so just knowing what you're thinking, that it sounds so simple, but, or knowing that you're thinking, but it's enough. So it's enough. And there are some more techniques that the Buddha taught. So I want to bring us to these. These five are from the Middle Length Discourses, Sutta number 20, called the Vitaka Santana Sutta, the relaxation of thoughts. And I'm going to share a little bit from Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translation of the Pali, which he offered to us in 1997. And then a little bit from Shayla Catherine, who has done a lot of work with these suttas. And she has a book out. I have not read it yet myself. I've heard her give teachings on this topic. I think the book is called, does somebody know here? I think it's called Distracting Thoughts. But anyhow, Shayla Catherine, and she's a fantastic teacher down in the peninsula of California. Okay, so here's the first of these five sort of suggestions. And as you listen to these, just see what lands, you know? That's how we always do with Dharma anyway. We find what's really truly workable for us. Yeah, so I have heard, this is Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translation. I've heard that on one occasion, the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi in Jetta's grove. There he addressed the practitioners, Bhikkhus, practitioners. Yes, Lord, they replied. The Blessed One said, when a practitioner is intent on the heightened mind, meaning, you know, a kind of a contented mind, there are five themes they should attend to at the appropriate times. Which five? One. There is the case when unwholesome, unskillful thoughts arise in a practitioner. They should attend, when this happens, the practitioner should attend to another theme apart from that one, and the new theme should be connected with what is skillful or wholesome. And he goes on, but I'm just going to stop there and say more about that. Essentially, what he's saying is, when you notice that your mind has gone on some tangent that is just depressing you or making you anxious, you can deliberately replace that unhelpful thought with something more skillful. Every time you practice mindfulness, that's what you're doing. You know, not necessarily that the thoughts that you're setting down in order to come into the present moment were challenging, but you're practicing that capacity to set down the very compelling, addictive storyline of the default mode network of the wandering mind. You're practicing your capacity to put that down and replace it with something more wholesome, which is mindfulness, which is present moment awareness, in which, you know, like I was saying, insight and new response and care and compassion can arise rather than being lost in the trance of the thoughts. So mindfulness itself is this first strategy. The third foundation of mindfulness is this first strategy. Replace unhelpful thought with a more helpful, something more helpful. The Buddha goes on, just as a skilled carpenter or their apprentice would use a small peg to knock out and pull out a large one, in the same way, if unskillful thoughts arise in a practitioner, they can attend to another theme, one that is skillful. So it's not only mindfulness, but our heart practices, or, you know, sometimes I'll give you a couple of examples from my own life. One is, if I notice my mind judging someone, that's not something I want to have continue. I don't want to be randomly negatively judging people. There's conditioning in my mind from God knows when, middle school or something, and it'll produce that. When I notice that the mind has produced a judgment of another person, like say, I don't like their jacket or something like that, I immediately replace it with loving kindness. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And I can feel it's just like pouring cool water on my system to offer that, to have that my mind offer that as a replacement for an unskillful mental habit. Another thing that I recommend that I do myself is with the waking up in the night worry thoughts, I will practice gratitude. Just deliberately step away from whatever the worry is and say, I'm grateful for, you know, my health. I'm grateful for my dog. I'm grateful for. And you can also, it's very helpful to you to hold on to fingers, especially if it's in the middle of the night, because the compelling nature of the wandering mind is pretty strong. And somaticizing or bringing a little bit of the felt sense in as you name your gratitudes can really help. And it turns out, I had just done this because I noticed it helped. And then it turned out that this holding on to fingers is a technique used in Eastern health traditions, and that's also been used more recently in juvenile detention centers to help kids re-regulate. And I read that that's because there's so many nerve endings in the hands that connect up with the prefrontal cortex. So gratitude is another really, and you can try it like that if that appeals to you, can be a really helpful replacement strategy. Mindfulness, self-compassion, compassion, you know, whatever your practices are that you work with, they can all be used in this way. So that's the first one. The Buddha taught that to take these in order, and if the first one doesn't work, go to the second one and on to the third one. And that can be helpful. That can be a helpful suggestion. I have found as I practice with these and teach them to others that sometimes people already have, you know, you might go right on to number two or number three or four or five because it works for you. And of course, obviously, that's great too. So the second one, this is the Buddha again. If unskillful thoughts still arise in the practitioner, they can scrutinize the drawbacks of those thoughts. Truly, these thoughts of mine are unskillful. These thoughts of mine are blameworthy. These thoughts of mine result in stress. As they scrutinize the drawbacks of these thoughts, they are abandoned and subside. So the second strategy is to really explore the dangers of just hanging out with these thoughts. You know, like my story of really being clear that somehow some habit energy has carried through. And I don't blame myself. The brain's tendency to judge self and others goes back to our ancestors. I read that our ancestors had to decide in fractions of a second when they were seeing other humans approaching, whether they were safe or not. And from that, this whole judging thing that our minds do, that's one of the sources. So, and yet it's workable, you know? And so seeing that this was a habit that I did not want to pursue and was part of my motivation to cultivate an immediate response of metta when I saw it arise in my mind, understanding and exploring the dangers of pursuing that thought. If you know, you know, okay, you know, when I obsess about too much about, you know, certain things in the news, very common. You know, there's certain things I can do. I can write postcards, I can sign signatures, I can go out and protest. Definitely want to do whatever I can do. But when I go down a rabbit hole around the news, I'm helping no one and I'm getting paralyzed by it. So if I'm clear about that, understanding and exploring the dangers of pursuing the thought, what are we conditioning in our minds by continuing to ruminate on something negative? Because that's what we're doing. We're conditioning something to arise again. I'm giving it energy and my mind goes, oh, she likes that. We'll do that again. So getting clear, like this is actually not serving me, can very often just lift it. And it's not that it doesn't come back necessarily, it very often does, but there's more and more lightness around it, less and less over time as we continue going, oh yeah, that's the place that actually isn't serving me. Then it's easier and easier to not invest our life energy in it anymore. So that's the second one. So basically, you know, there's the just simply noticing that we're gonna come back to the present moment with a thought, the replacing. Then there's more of that investigating. And then the third one, here is the Buddha again. Unskillful thoughts still arise. Then the instruction from the Buddha is pay no mind and pay no attention to those thoughts. As you are paying no mind and paying no attention, they can be abandoned and subside. So that means that there can be times, even though we want to be present, with mindfulness we want to be present, there can be times when it can be skillful to just look away, just distract yourself from it, go out, take a walk. No. Just go ahead and do something different. Really, really skillful. This shows up in trauma-sensitive mindfulness teachings a lot. because thoughts that are fueled by trauma can have a very deep energy to them, and they can also be overwhelming. And the teaching is we touch in and then we look away. We deliberately look away. Look for what's beautiful or comforting or just even that will something that will distract us away from those difficult thoughts for a while. So obviously, we have a culture that uses distraction excessively, and we're not talking about that. We're not talking about, spending the rest of your life in a video game. But there can be times when distraction is a really skillful tool. So that's the third one. This reminds me of a teaching that I heard from Buddhist teacher Christiane Wolf. I'm not sure this is hers, but I don't know who to credit it to, but I did hear it from her. And this is the teaching of the waterfall. That just as you, when you see a waterfall, you are not going to like wave a magic wand and make the waterfall stop. It's going to keep pouring out its water. Sometimes thoughts are like that. And you're not going to make them stop. They've got so much momentum. They're just going to be doing their thing. And so at that point, this idea of, turning away, looking at something else, what's skillful if you're like right in the waterfall and it's pounding down in your head, what would be skillful is step back so that you're not in the waterfall. And similarly, with these kinds of thoughts, sometimes it's just really wise to just step out of the waterfall of thoughts and do something else. Okay. That's three. I'm just going to, we're already at time. We're almost done. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I'm just going to say the last two. So the fourth one is really looking into the root causes, the creating of a sense of self that thoughts do. And when we do that, it can really disintegrate their power. And then the last one is from a place of compassion, but not aversion, just saying no, which I know sounds like suddenly I'm sounding like Nancy Reagan, but that's what the Buddha said. Sometimes, not from aversion, not from self-hate, ever, ever, but from compassion, it's possible to just say no. And sometimes I'll just say shh, and the thought will stop. So thank you for your kind attention. Some ideas.
May I just tell everyone the name of the book by Shyla Catherine is
Please, please.
Beyond Distraction, Five Practical Ways to Focus the Mind. And
Beautiful.
it's like a summary of your talk tonight. It's a very good book.
Oh, great. You've read it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. Great. Oh, I'm so glad. Wonderful. Thank you.